Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, we hear about an exhibit that honors the life and work of artist Ruth Asawa. Then, a photo book takes viewers back to the early days of the Grateful Dead. And a film festival that shines a spotlight on Black activism. Today's show is about legacies. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden. Ruth Asawa is a familiar name in the visual arts world. But if you don't know her name and have spent a lot of time in San Francisco, you've likely seen her work. Ruth Asawa was a Japanese-American artist known for creating wire sculptures and public art installations, like the Mermaid Fountain in Ghirardelli Square, and a sculpture at the Embarcadero in the city, and the Garden of Remembrance at San Francisco State University. Just beautiful pieces. She also spent much of her time and much of her life advocating for art education. And you can learn more about her at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Arts exhibit, Ruth Asawa Retrospective. It has more than 300 pieces of her work that span over six decades. And here to talk about this wonderful exhibit is one of the curators, Janet Bishop. Hey, Janet.
Hi, Janae.
Janet, you know, you work in art, you work for the museum. When you were first introduced to Ruth's work, what were your initial thoughts?
Oh, I remember seeing it at the de Young Museum and her retrospective in the early 2000s, and I found it absolutely mesmerizing. And I knew that she was somebody that I wanted to learn a lot more about.
And the setup of the exhibit is really gorgeous. And, you know, when you first enter the exhibit, there's a quote from Ruth Asawa that says, "An artist is an ordinary person who takes the ordinary things and make them special." How does that speak to her as an artist from how she used unique materials such as wire and paper and glass too, as well, to just create some really just amazing pieces?
Yeah, I love that quote that we have at the entrance to the show, because on the one hand, it speaks to her humility. She says an artist is an ordinary person, which I don't know that I fully agree with. I think artists are pretty special. But then her belief that really any material could be viable for art making. Wire was an ordinary material, commercially available. You know, she used anything ranging from some paper to potatoes and apples and bike pedals to make prints. She did use fine art materials also. She cast things into bronze, she used wood, but she was just so resourceful and again, really, really anything could be used toward art making.
And you mentioned wire, and so she learned wire weaving in Mexico. Now, did she go there intentionally to learn, or was she just there and it just so happened she fell in love with that artistry?
No, it was really fortuitous. She went down during her college years at Black Mountain College. She visited Toluca, Mexico, and there were artisans in the markets who had developed this technique for looping wire to make baskets that were mainly used for holding eggs. Some of the baskets were shaped like chickens. Mm-hmm. She learned the technique and then really took to it. I think she could see its potential. She really responded to it in the materials. She liked the process. I mean, if you're someone who likes to knit, you might not even be able to explain why you like it so much, but she just really took to it. It was something that she could stop and start, which eventually would sort of become, compatible with family life, where if she got interrupted, she could set something down and then pick it up again. But in the late 1940s, in 1949, she closed up that wire form for the first time. She had experimented making baskets, sort of bowl-shaped baskets, and then she closed it up and hung it from the ceiling, suspended it from above, and that was a breakthrough that led to all the many amazing sort of themes and variations that you see in her suspended wire sculptures.
Oh, okay. Because I noticed all the suspended wire sculptures. So that's interesting. So that she was it was a basket, like you said, that she closed it up. And oh, wow. Okay, that's really interesting. So many other interesting things about her. During World War II, she spent some of her youth in a Japanese internment camp in Southern California and Arkansas. And after the war, she tried to be a teacher, but because of anti-Japanese racism, it was hard for her to find work. And so she ended up at art school in North Carolina, excuse me. And the school's called Black Mountain College. So how did all of that just, you know, and I know she was separated from her father for like 6 years. How did all of that influence her work? That's a
Yeah.
lot to, especially as a young person, as a child.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, she grew up on a farm, and one of the things that was, interesting about her incarceration experience, she was a teenager, and she and her mother and most of her siblings were held at what had been a racetrack, a horse racetrack, Santa Anita, and almost disorienting in some ways because she had time for the first time. She had been a really busy kid. If she wasn't doing schoolwork, she was farming. And so it was very unstructured. But there were Walt Disney animators who were also incarcerated at Santa Anita, who set up art classes for the kids. And it was the first time that she'd really worked alongside professional artists and found that to be inspiring, really, really memorable. And she had, as you said, she intended to become an art teacher after she graduated from high school, went to Milwaukee Teachers College, and in not being able to get a teaching position, it sort of she had to find another path. And so, some friends recommended Black Mountain College, outside Asheville. And that was a very experimental school environment where there was a lot of fluidity between, between the professors and the students, and she met some incredible people there. Two of her professors were Joseph Albers and Buckminster Fuller, and she had lifelong friendships with them. And it was a really intensely, intensely creative environment that she just responded to, 100%. And also met her future husband, Albert Lanier, who was an architecture student at Black Mountain. And then at the end of their time at the school, they moved to San Francisco, where they became their adopted home city and lived here. She lived here from 1949 for the rest of her life until she passed in 2013.
You know, that's amazing how you have a vision for your life and what you want to do, and then you get hit with a detour, and you know, and often it still turns out okay, you know. And it's funny because I wonder what kind of artist would she have been, or would she even been the artist she was if she had went straight on to be a teacher?
No, I mean that's a great. I mean, we'll never know, right? I
Right.
am convinced that she would have been an artist. She was someone who was just exuding, creativity. It was just kind of pouring out of her. But had she not gone to Mexico and learned that wire technique, she would have been doing something, but it wouldn't have been what we know her for today.
And something, one of her techniques that really caught my attention is how she uses, you know, negative space or blank space and light and causes shadows, right? So she'll have, like you said, like these suspended wire figures hanging. And then when you're in the exhibit, you notice the shadow of the figure and the lighting, and that all just adds more to the art, though that's all part of the art. Can you talk about that technique of hers that she uses with the light and the shadows and the
Yeah. So she a lot of her sculptures are forms within forms. So they'll be some of them are as many as, 5 or 6 layers of shape. So you get different experiences of the sort of density and transparency of these looped wire sculptures. If If you light them with one light, if they cast one shadow, you get one shadow. If you have two lights on them, there's two shadows. It was something I learned from our lighting technician here. She didn't specify exactly how they should be lit. She wasn't that controlling. But they really they really enhance the experience of the sculptures. And I think the shadows are something really special about experiencing them.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Janet Bishop. She is co-curator of the exhibit Ruth Asawa Retrospective at SF MoMA and is currently on display until September 2nd. So a lot of her works are untitled. Do you know why?
I think she was just wasn't really a language person, in the sense that it just wasn't her priority to sort of think up titles for them. Very few of them, as you say, have titles. Some of them, she made a lot of drawings of flowers and plants, and she would often record in her sketchbooks or on sheets of paper where the flowers might have come from. There's one that, for instance, is called Albert's Rose Bouquet, Albert being a reference to her husband. So he would have put together a bouquet, and then she drew it, and she wrote, and then she inscribed the sheet. So that has a title. Or she would note what type of plant something might be. But the sculptures are almost never titled. There's one that's called Winter Moss that she made for a set for a ballet that was performed in the 1980s at the Palace of Fine Arts. And that sculpture was made for a ballet of the same name. The production was called Winter Moss, so that one has a title, but very, very few of them do. I just don't think it was something that was important to her. She was more interested in the making. And so when you go in and see the show, you'll see labels that have descriptive titles that might say, single layered form, within a form or something. And that's really just to kind of identify them one to the next.
Something else that struck me that I learned about her in the exhibit was that she was offered a contract for her work to be mass produced, and so does home decor. And it's funny because when I was looking at some of like the wire baskets, I said, I would buy that having in my apartment. But she turned that down. Now, a lot of people wouldn't have turned that down, especially today. What does that say about her as an artist, just her ethics?
Yeah, I think she and her husband were interested in exploring the potential of producing works that that could be sold commercially. But I think doing the same thing over and over and over again was just not so interesting to her. She didn't really want to engage in production, and that's something that really became clear to me when we assembled all of the works for the exhibition and were installing them, is that every single piece is unique. She never repeated herself. There's a lot of theme and variations, but she didn't just do the same thing again and again. And so while she might have made a go at commercial production, it just ultimately wasn't interesting enough for someone who had this, really sort of intensely creative kind of mind and tactile intelligence. She really needed to keep moving.
One of the things I really liked about the exhibit is how you all recreated her living room in Noe Valley. And I read that she actually hung some of her sculptures from her ceiling, which, why not? Because her work is gorgeous. And I was thinking too, and I was looking at the images, and she had a big family with six kids. And so I could just imagine with the art and the kids and just the energy. Why did SF MoMA want to recreate that space?
Well, I think her living room was really kind of the center of her, creative output for so many years. They moved in 1961 and lived there for the rest of their lives. Her family has described how, the door was never locked, the gate was never locked, people were just coming and going. And she had a studio that was underneath the living room, but she really preferred working kind of upstairs in the main space, adjacent to the kitchen, just in the mix with the rest of the family. It was an arts and crafts house and it had high ceilings, so it really lent itself to her the installation of her sculptures from the rafters. And her kids have sort of joked around and said, back in the day there would have been pencils and paper airplanes stuck in them. That's not how we display them at SF MoMA.
And her, some of her kids are artists, correct?
Yes,
Okay.
absolutely. Iko, Kunio, Paul Lanier, and a very strong creative streak running through the family. But one other thing about the living room gallery is that we've hung the sculptures high and also provided seating, and so you can experience them
Yes.
underneath, which is kind of cool. There it's sort of fun to stare at them and try and figure out how she made them, where she started, where she stopped. But being able to look at them from below offers a different view that is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I love how you actually feel like you're in her living room. I really enjoyed that. And we have a little less than a minute to go. I want to briefly talk about her advocacy for art education. When we look back at her legacy, what did she leave behind as far as advocating for art education in San Francisco? Why did she think studying art was important?
That became a huge priority for her in the 1960s, as her own kids were entering school, and she was not very impressed with the kinds of assignments that they were getting, that were related to art, and so just decided to make the world she wanted to see. So she banded together with a group of friends, other sort of Noe Valley moms, and they started an arts program in at the Alvarado School, and that eventually spread to several other schools throughout the city. But she became our arts advocacy became really as high a priority as anything for her. And at one point, she was asked the question what she thought her greatest contribution career long was, and she said her work in the schools.
Wow. It's a really amazing exhibit. And Janet Bishop, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate you for coming in and talking
Thank
to
you, Janae. Nice to talk to you.
us. Janet Bishop is the co-curator of the exhibit Ruth Asawa Retrospective, and is currently running at SF MoMA until September 2nd. And coming up, a photo book that celebrates the Grateful Dead and an iconic photographer. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden. Long before Beyonce's Beehive and Taylor Swift's Swifties, the Deadheads were rocking it out to the Grateful Dead. And next month marks the 60th anniversary of the founding of the Grateful Dead. The psychedelic rock band from the Bay Area gave rise to the counterculture movement of the 1960s and 70s. The late iconic music photographer Jim Marshall captured much of the band's career and life. He took over 10,000 photos of the Grateful Dead and snapped historic moments like their performance at Woodstock and their last free concert in the Hate. Over 200 of those photos are featured in the book The Grateful Dead by Jim Marshall, and it covers their formative years from 1966 to 1977. And here to talk more about the book is co-author and photographer Amelia Davis. She was Jim Marshall's personal assistant, and she preserves his work as the sole beneficiary of his estate. And also joining us is music fan, writer, German history scholar, all the things, Dan Sullivan. Dan is a lifelong Deadhead, and he contributed an essay to the book. Welcome, Amelia and Dan.
Thank you
so
for
much
having
for
us.
having us. This is awesome.
Yeah, I'm so happy you all are here. And we got to talk earlier before the show, so I've just really enjoyed learning more about you and getting to know you. Amelia, I want to start with you. So you're a photographer. You were Jim's personal assistant. He photographed not just the Grateful Dead, but Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Buddy Guy, activists, Cesar Chavez, all kind of folks. He was there. He was like Forrest Gump. He captured so much history.
Exactly.
So much history. Yes. So for you, what was that like, working with someone just has seen so much.
It was amazing. I have to say, Jim, I think they broke the mold when they made Jim. Because he was everywhere that mattered. But the thing with Jim is photography was his love and it was his life. Mm-hmm. So he never left home without a camera because he wanted to document everything he saw. And everything he saw was history because it was happening around him. And, you know, he had the benefit of the 60s and the 70s when a lot of these movements, a lot of these bands were forming. And he was there photographing it. And I just think we're so lucky to have his photos now mm-hmm. to look back on history, and especially with the Grateful Dead, because there's so many fans that had fathers or grandparents, and they all, you know, kind of come together around the Grateful Dead, right. and they can look and share the photographs that Jim captured.
And as I was telling you earlier, I grew up near the Oakland Coliseum. Yeah. So we always knew when it was a Grateful Dead concert because we would see the fans, my mother and I, and the way the fans would dress. Dan, I probably saw you when
I
was a little girl.
You probably saw me there for some New Year's show, many a show at the Coliseum.
So that's, you know, that's what I remember about the Grateful Dead. And so in the book, Jim, someone wrote in an essay that he was both wildly talented and compulsively self-destructive. Yes. So he was a character.
He really was. Yeah. I mean, Jim, but I think that's what made him such a great photographer. And most artists are that way. They have a very, you know, a great side to them, but they have a very destructive side as well. And that, you know, that's what makes them unique. But I have to say that putting this book together, for me, I was never really a deadhead. I'm outing myself here. But for me, it was the photography. It's always mm-hmm. been the photography. And through doing this book, I really learned about the Grateful Dead through Jim's photographs. And they really, I think when you look at the photographs, you can hear the music mm-hmm. and you can really feel as if you were there. And that's the beauty of Jim's photography, is you always feel like you're a participant. You never feel like a voyeur outside looking in. You really feel like you're there with them. And Dan and I really want, it was important to make it feel as if you were part of the family.
Yeah.
And I think that comes across in the book. It's very intimate. Mm-hmm. Whereas a lot of other books are just, you know, them up on stage jamming and singing. You never really see them in the house, 710 Ashbury.
Right, or just sitting on the porch.
Yeah.
And
or just joking with mm-hmm. each other. Or even just walking up and down the street, right?
Yeah, exactly. How did you decide what to pick? I mean, from 10,000 photos to narrow it down to 200, how did
it
you do that?
Hard.
How long did it take?
It took us 3 years, basically.
Wow. Okay.
Because what we had to do with Jim, he had a card on the Grateful Dead, but it didn't cross-reference with other bands that he played with mm-hmm. or events that they played at.
Yeah.
So we had to be meticulously going through all and cross-referencing these. So sometimes, you know, there's a card on Janis Joplin and Big Brother and the mm-hmm. Holding Company. And so we had to look through that because they often played together a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of these San Francisco bands played together. So what was wonderful, though, is we unearthed a lot of gems. And sometimes I think we felt like archaeologists, you know, going on a dig, and we'd find these treasures and say, oh my God, look what we found. And it was so exciting. So that's, for us, it's exciting to share it with the world because we've been in this for 3 years and now we're like, everybody can see it.
Yeah. And these are photos. A lot of these photos, you know, people haven't seen before. Now, Dan, you are a deadhead. And I know you are thrilled to be a part of this book because we talked about this earlier. Okay. You're from Detroit. You live in the Bay. Mm-hmm. And so you got exposed to like R&B and blues. And you also spent a chunk of your childhood living in Europe. So I'm thinking of just the rock that you got exposed to. So you definitely have a serious relationship with music. And so you are a serious deadhead because I understand from your essay that they inspired you to move to Oakland.
That's a serious
fan. I just went to the Beyonce concert. I don't know if I would move to Houston, but you moved to Oakland.
Yeah, I was interested long ago, back in high school days in England, in the global counterculture, the youth counterculture.
Yeah.
I was a young hippie in the 70s, right?
Yeah.
And it's formative. A lot of the formative years of that were right here by the Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And the bands we've been talking about, and Quicksilver and the Dead and the Airplane and so forth. I was into all that music. But as I said in my essay, it was a bit of an organizing principle for my life, like a lot of deadheads. Like you organize your life around going on tour and what shows you could catch and this and that. And I came out here from New York, where I was living in 1985, to see the 20th anniversary shows at the Greek Theater in Berkeley, and it changed my life. It was my first time in the Bay Area, and I was like, this is my place, these are my people. And within 2 years, I was working at the United Nations. I had a great gig, chucked it all, moved out to Oakland, and here I am all these years later. So the band was very important to my life,
And so at first in your essay, you talked about how you weren't really feeling them when you first heard them.
Absolutely.
What was the shift? What made you change your mind?
Like a lot of deadheads, the change goes down when you see them in concert. And it sounds like cliche, but, you know, the first time I got to see them live, I really understood what was going on musically, which was a conversation happening in real time on stage. Their roots were, Jerry Garcia's roots in particular, were in bluegrass. And it's a conversational musical style. And his whole idea was, wouldn't it be great if we could do this in an electric rock and roll format, right after the Beatles and the Stones blew everybody's young mind, and all the folkies went electric? Well, that's the roots of the Grateful Dead. So fast forward to 1980 in Michigan, my first live show after being like, I don't really get this band. And I'm watching them talk to each other, throwing ideas back and forth for the 3 hours of the show and improvising.
Yeah,
that's when I got it. I'm like, this is really cool. This is a really cool and unique kind of music.
And the just to riff off of what Dan was saying, I think Jim, as a photographer, his instrument was his camera. And so when he was on stage with them, he was communicating and talking with them through his camera. So he's telling that visual story with his camera, and I think that they just were able to dance together and really vibe off of each other.
And off stage, that's the really cool thing about this book. As Amelia said, it's very intimate. Jim was family with them, and there's these pictures from 1966 and 67 in their home and hanging out with their partners and girlfriends and everything.
Yeah, when I saw that, I was like, oh, okay.
That was one of the coolest things about this project for me. I think the secret stars of this book, there's two of them. It's Carolyn Mountain Girl Garcia, right? And it's Rosie McGee, who was Phil Lesh, the bass player's girlfriend at the time. You guys found so many beautiful pictures of these women.
Yeah.
And David Gans, who co-curated the book with Amelia, has personal connections with it. He's a dead historian and author and musician. And he got those women to talk, and those are the stories. This is photos
the
stories.
The stories are good, and the relationships and the love. And
they were the real. They started the merch, and they never get recognized for that. Yeah. They had
really,
yeah.
Suzela,
who was
Bill Kreutzmann's first wife,
had a used clothing store over in Marin, and they just tie dyed some shirts. They said, "Why don't we do this and see if they sell?" And they sold.
They
were some of the first people to silk screen band shirts. It's like they started band merch. It's amazing.
Yeah. You know, and that's why, you know, this book, again, it's not just a history of Jim. It's not just a history of the Grateful Dead. It's a history of the Bay Area.
Right.
I do want to play a clip of Jim. I want to bring his voice into this discussion. And he's speaking in this video that was shown at his memorial service in 2011, made by Sean Dane. I hope I pronounced their name right. And Jim talks about seeing himself as a reporter with a camera.
I mean, as out there as I am, when I'm photographing, I've kind of become a fly on the wall and just want to document it. I don't even think of myself as a photographer, you know, like a lot of guys. I'm a reporter with a camera. When I'm shooting, 95% of me is involved in the event, but 5% of me has to be outside as the mechanic who uses this machine called a camera, or in my case, a Leica. I think it's something I was born with, that I just have maybe this innate sense of what feels right or what looks right. Like I say, one of the things I'm most proud of, no one's ever complained about what picture I used, never. I'm really proud of that.
He said he was proud because no one ever complained about a picture he took, and he didn't fully put himself in the picture. He knew how to take himself out.
Totally.
And balance between being the photographer and being the observer.
Yeah.
So I just thought that clip was really interesting.
Great, yeah.
Yeah. Did he change music photography? I mean, he's considered one of the greatest. So did he change the game and change the style of shooting artists?
He did. He was pretty much considered the pioneer of music photography. And so he had all access, and that's what he demanded, actually. And so that's why he was able to get the photos that he did and really, you know, bring the humanity to the musicians. So it wasn't just these musicians that everybody puts up on a pedestal as gods, right?
Yeah.
They were also human. And that's what Jim was able to bring through his photography. And he really did influence a whole generation of music photographers and photojournalists through his style and what he did. And I don't think that can, you know, that was a period in time that will not happen again because the whole music industry has completely changed.
Yeah.
And now it's handlers and managers and they, you know, you're in a pit and you have 2 minutes to photograph. And so, you know, what they did, mm-hmm. I don't think could ever happen again, really.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with co-author Amelia Davis and music fan, deadhead, writer Dan Sullivan. The photo book, The Grateful Dead by Jim Marshall, comes out on Tuesday, August 5th. So it's out soon. And we got to see it here at Sights and Sounds. And it's really spectacular. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, so is it true that the members, they didn't like having their photo taken?
They didn't.
They certainly didn't like to pose.
No,
that was the thing. And they like to mess with people too.
Yeah.
They like to torture the photographers. I think it's not fair to say.
Yes.
Mess with them.
So for you as a fan, I mean, I know you contributed to this book, but for you as a fan, Dan, what does this mean for
it's
you?
It's all about the history that I was too young to be. I wasn't around in 1966. So going through these pictures, it just blew, and earlier, a couple years before when I was doing some archival work to help Amelia out, and coming across these pictures, especially like the Kodachrome color slides,
yeah.
It's amazing. It's like time travel. And Jim's photography, like Amelia said, is intimate.
Mm-hmm.
Partly there was, if I understand it, it was technical. It was the kind of lenses he used, and he got close, and he had the access. But it's also... it's like a time machine to see the beginnings of not just the band, but San Francisco in 1966, 67, when things were changing real fast, but it hadn't really blown up. It was still just local hippies getting up on, you know, in the panhandle of a Sunday afternoon and playing on a flatbed.
Yeah.
And he captured all that stuff. So for me, who didn't really get into the band until around 1978, 79, 80, it was just, it's a treasure trove of history. And also, I'm a big fan of the Bay Area and our history. And this book, it's incredible. The architecture, the neighborhood kids in the background. It's just beautiful. It's a time capsule and really historical timeline.
And it's fun, too, because you can see how fashion, how they really
influenced
fashion, right? And for them, it was out of necessity because they didn't have a lot of money. So they would go to the used clothing stores and put things together. But people thought that was so cool.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the world followed suit started dressing like these guys did. So it just touches on so many different things, music, culture, fashion, even, you know, civil rights, because we're talking about the Haight-Ashbury was predominantly an African-American neighborhood before the hippies moved in. And when the hippies moved in, they all melded together.
Mm-hmm.
They really learned how to love each other and come together. And Jim took some pictures of mixed race marriages, which is, you know, at this time in the United States, there was still segregation going on.
Yeah.
So it's pretty incredible to see these photographs.
And there was a black woman that was with, what was his name?
Pigpen.
Yeah.
That was really interesting going through this. Getting
his name,
story.
V?
Veronica.
Yeah.
V. Yeah. And live with them in 710 Ashbury while she was going to nursing
school. Yeah, see, and I didn't, you know, being black in Oakland, it's like, what? It was a sister with the grandma. So that's why I said, you know, I learned so much. And we have to wrap up. I told you this was going to go by so fast.
Oh, no.
I know. It's like we're just getting warmed up. You know, yes, this is The Grateful Dead, but this book is just as much about Jim.
Yeah.
You know, so what would you say is his legacy?
I think Jim's legacy is basically documenting history as it happened. And also his legacy is telling a story through his photographs.
Yeah.
And I think that's very important, especially now and with a younger generation influencing them and letting them know that they still do have a voice. You know, a lot of us feel helpless right now and like we don't really have a voice. You do, you can make a change, and you can tell a very powerful story through your photography. And I think Jim really shows that and has inspired a lot of the next generations of photojournalists.
Dan, did you want to add something?
No, I think that captures it really well. And the book's amazing. The project's been so much fun. It's been 3 years of hard work. And I know people appreciate it. The last thing I'll say is that the reactions so far have been great. The ones that mean the most to me are from the people who's told those stories, who lived it.
Yeah.
They're really happy with it. And I don't care what anyone else says. This was their lives. And they say that we did right by them. I'm happy.
Okay. Well, that if the dead heads approve, then okay, then you know you're doing the right thing. Amelia and Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you
so much for having us.
Amelia Davis is co-author of The Grateful Dead by Jim Marshall, and music fan and writer Dan Sullivan contributed an essay to the book. The Grateful Dead by Jim Marshall will be out in bookstores next Tuesday, August 5th. And next up, we hear about a film festival that honors the Black Arts Movement. Keep it locked right here. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darden. Have you heard of Black August? For the entire month of August, people honor the organizers, activists, and political prisoners who have fought for Black liberation. And in Oakland, some folks in the community are recognizing the month with the Black Arts Movement Film Fest, or BAM Film Fest, and it's a multi-day celebration of Black life and storytelling through film. You can also check out Q&A panels and mixers. They got all kind of stuff coming up. The festival is happening at the BAM House and other locations in downtown Oakland from August 1st to the 3rd. And here to talk more about the event is the festival's director, Shaka Jamal. Hey, Shaka!
Hey, I'm doing great.
I love film festivals. So I'm glad that, you know, this is happening. But before we even talk about the festival, you are a filmmaker.
Yes.
And I read in your bio that you were the camera operator from the Emmy Award-winning documentary We Are the Dream, the Kids of the Martin Luther King Oratorical Festival, which was produced by HBO and the Bay Area's Mahershala Ali. And you're
also here in Oakland. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. And you're the first filmmaker from the town to receive the Game Changers Fellowship, which led to you premiering short documentaries at Harlem's Schomburg Center, which I love. That's such a great place. I haven't been there in a long time. But I understand that living in South Africa inspired your passion for film. So briefly tell us how.
Well, I had a whole bunch of photography and video that I collected throughout my time as a Peace Corps volunteer over 2 years there, living in a rural village called Shawela.
Right?
And when I got back, I was sitting at the Java House. Y'all know that.
I remember the Java House. Yes.
Java House. Shout out Dwayne Wiggins.
Yes, yes.
Sister Tarita, who's a Black Panther, came up and said, you want to learn how to edit for free? Come talk to me afterwards. I was like, hey, she talking to me. And I ended up joining the program, learning how to edit. And then next thing I know, I'm shooting music videos, working on documentaries. And I ended up going to SF State for my master's in cinema.
Nice.
Working for community organizations all around Oakland, and now I'm here.
Shout out to Tarita McHale, who's a poet, yes, and rest in peace.
Oh, yeah.
Empowered to Dwayne Wiggins. So this film festival, how does it honor, you know, Black August and just Black activism?
Well, one of the key things is Sunday, we're going to have a Black August panel with some of the original founders of the Black August Organizing Committee. Mm-hmm. Mama Ayana, many of y'all know her as a community healer.
Mm-hmm.
Baba Fatih, Yaro Kambon, and also Minister King X. And it's going to be like Black August then and now, because Minister King X is younger than them. So we're going to have a panel so people to learn what is it all about. Right.
Uh-huh.
And also, it's also to honor the Black Arts Movement. We're dedicating this also to Nikki Giovanni, you know, one of the pioneers of the Black Arts Movement, along with Amiri Baraka, and also Oscar Micheaux, which is a pioneer in Black filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
So our films And what we talk about is all in honor of those who came before and those who have made sometimes the greatest sacrifice for us to be here today. Those who use their art as a tool to liberate the people. And even though we had political prisoners who were locked up inside unjustly, they took that time to say, hey, we're going to educate ourselves. We're going to educate our other brothers and sisters who are locked up inside to look at the world in a different way so that we can liberate ourselves and all of those around us.
And this year's theme is inheritance.
Oh, yeah.
Which I was like, wow, that's deep. And so talk about, like, you know, that theme and why did you all decide on that theme?
Well, the film festival, BAM Film Fest, is co-founded by Dr. Wordslanger and Zynga, Dr. Ayodele Wordslanger and Zynga.
Yes.
And she sets the charge for us in what we do. And it's the stories we have the right to tell, right? And so she said, with that, we can start bringing in documentaries that tells the stories about where we actually came from, right? Those people who are trailblazers. Just like opening night, we're going to play a documentary called John Burr's Godfather of Police Litigation.
Yes,
some
okay.
Some of you know he represented the family for Oscar Grant. He represented Tupac Shakur when he was assaulted by the police, and many other people who have been, you know, unjustly treated by the police. Mm-hmm. So we're honoring his dedication to our people and being able to bring justice to our community.
Okay. And I interviewed John Burris for UC Berkeley, and he did not tell me he was having a documentary. And I talked to John Burris. I talked to John Burris for a couple days. And I was like, and then I, like, literally weeks after that, and I said, he had a documentary come out, he didn't even tell me. So shout out to John Burris. Definitely has a fascinating life. And I've heard definitely, you know, good things about that documentary. I like that theme, inheritance. I think, too, especially because now we're living in such a time where people are feeling, you know, things are being taken away from them. People are struggling, you know, just trying to hold on. And so to remind us of inheritance and that, you know, that there's something we do have and that we can pass on, you know.
There's our right to tell it and our responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. So I really like that theme. If you're just joining us, I'm chatting with Shaka Jamal. He's the organizer of the Black Arts Movement Film Fest, and it's happening at BAM House and other locations in downtown Oakland from August 1st to August 3rd. So, okay, so the film festival is happening in three venues. Again, BAM House, and then African American Museum and Library, and Oak Stop. So all kind of just in that area. Screening over 40 films. Tell us what some other films that viewers can expect to see. I will be attending this. I love film festivals.
Hey, you know, I'm text messaging filmmakers all the time. Right now, I was just text messaging producer Denise Kamalo, who's actually flying up from LA to show her animated short, The Matumbilas. This is about an East African family. It's quite amusing. And that's part of the African inheritance segment. Where we're going to be featuring a music video from Kingmakers of Oakland. They're working with a South African animator named Saizo. What else are we going to have? Oh, this is exclusive.
Okay.
This just got ink in today.
Okay.
So HBO is giving us the rights to screen the new Eyes on the Prize series, right? One episode, which was produced by Naima Jordan, a producer from out of Oakland.
Yeah.
Right? We're going to screen that 7 p.m. Saturday at BAM House, and it's free, right? So we just want to bring all the people out and watch that film right there. We've been working for weeks and weeks trying to get the clearance to show that film.
Congratulations. Now, when does that Eyes of the Prize, what decade or era does that take place in that documentary? Do you know?
Well, right now, this is the new series.
Right, because it's new. Right? Yeah.
So it's called What Happens After Hope. So it's like 2008 to 2015. We know that's the Barack Obama era.
Right.
So it's about all the different movements that were going on during that time.
Okay. Okay. You know, you mentioned Naima Jordan. I was like, there's, you know, I know when we think of film, we always think of LA, and I'm like, there's so many, you know, really great filmmakers here in the Bay Area that we have. And that's why I always try to encourage people to go to film festivals. I know some people are they're frustrated with, you know, the action heroes and the sci-fi movies and the you know, the comic book movies that we're seeing, you know, in mainstream theaters. And I'm like, there's so many people that are producing great, right, unique work, and it's being screened at film festivals. So it makes a huge difference when you go to film festivals and support these artists and these filmmakers. And we have a few more minutes, but
go ahead. Can I highlight that we're going to also close with a called Oaktivism, because we have these film groups. So Oaktivism is going to be 7:30 Sunday night. It's going to be all films about Oakland created by Oakland filmmakers.
Oh my gosh!
Right? That's coming. Look, Saturday, we got a free breakfast for kids, right, in honor of the Black Panthers.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you, what do you have for the youth?
Mm-hmm. For the youth, so Saturday morning, 9:30 a.m., we have a free breakfast and a Black Studies program led by Tyson Amir, right? So I want people to come out there, and that's going to be at our Oak Stop venue.
Okay. Oh my goodness! I definitely want to see that. I'm at the movies.
Right after that is going to be films about youth and created by youth. Directly after that one.
So we got
women in film panel. That's going to be happening. We have a film about the evolution of blues in Oakland, made by film director Cheryl Fabio.
Oh my goodness.
Whose mother was actually part of the Black Arts Movement.
I feel like I'm just gonna get some sweats and just sit at Vam House Oak Stop and Amlo all weekend.
We have all access passes where you can pay one flat fee and just be with us for the whole weekend.
Okay. And then we're going to have a link on our website for people. You can say the website if you want, but we'll have a link on our website for people to buy tickets.
You just go to Eventbrite, put in BAM Film Fest, and then you'll see all the different events. And you can get the all access pass, the day pass. You can buy one ticket or just RSVP for one of the free events or screenings.
Okay. This is great. So this is great too. You know, you talk about youth. So for people who have, you know, if you're young, if you're listening, you got grandkids, kids, nieces and nephews, and they're aspiring to be filmmakers. So this is an event for them to go to as well, right? So they can learn just about the ins and outs of, film.
Yes, it's for all ages. You know, the youth all the way to the folks that are interested in the eyes on the prize, right?
Yeah.
We have Hour of Chaos, a documentary featuring Chuck D. And our local DJ and hip hop historian Davey D.
Okay,
we got so much going on.
Yeah. Okay, I'm excited. I would definitely be at this. I'm gonna go to something because I'm like, I don't know which one to pick. So this BAM Film Fest started back in 2019. Yes. And were you the original director organizer of it?
Yes, I was originally director, co-founded with Dr. Nzinga.
Okay. So how did it come about that you all wanted to do a film festival? Because that's a big task. It is not easy doing I've been a part of film festivals, and it's not easy.
It is. Well, we are old school collaborating partners.
Okay.
With film, music, screenwriting. And right now, this film festival kicks off the month-long arts festival dedicated to the Black Arts Movement and Black August.
Okay.
Right? So the first 3 days, we're going to watch films, but then after that, she's curating the rest with plays, two trains running. There's going to be poetry. There's going to be performances. So this is just a whole big month that she's actually been putting on, I think, since maybe 2015, 2017. Then 2019, we added in the film segment, because it's biennial, every 2 years.
Okay, thank you for reminding me that this is something that's part of a big month-long event and celebration just of Black art. So definitely also to folks, you know, check that out to see not just the film festival but other events. I want to ask you, go back to you being a filmmaker, we have a couple more minutes, Shaka.
Okay.
Do you prefer I like asking filmmakers this, do you prefer like fiction, or do you prefer like documentaries as far as you as an artist that you like to create?
As an artist, definitely documentary is one thing I've been into. I was a history major at Tuskegee University.
All right, HBCUs.
Yes. So I think the research component to that has brought me into doing documentary, and I just love being around people. You know, they say, you know, the elders are living libraries.
So yes.
I just love being in their presence, being able to document that and uplift it. But I'm also venturing out and doing more of narratives, just like a film, Dawn, that I'm working on with Shia Shabazz Smith, that we actually have a Kickstarter for. And we have one more day. So y'all go to Kickstarter, put in Dawn the movie. Hey, we need y'all's help to finish up this film, which we've shot here in Oakland and San Francisco.
Okay.
But I love music videos. I started out my career working on music videos, right? So that's also been a big component of my career.
So we have 20 seconds. What does this festival mean to you?
Hey, as a kid who grew up in here in Oakland, I really say this is my love and my dedication, my gift to bring back to Oakland. Like, this is what you have poured into me. I'm pouring this back into Oakland and want to share it with the community, with these films that are made by young people, by elders, and that's for young people in our entire community. And y'all should just come out and support. And most importantly, we have an opening night reception and ancestor upliftment at 5:30. We're asking the community to come out. We're going to have a procession with Baba Moshe,
that's gonna be so nice.
Omira. So we really want to bring up the energy and honor. We're going to have a picture of Nikki Giovanni and Oscar Michaud there. And some community members if they have people that they want to place on the altar. It's going to be beautiful.
All right. Shaka Jamal, thank you so much. Shaka Jamal is BAM Film Fest organizer and director. The festival is happening in Oakland's Black Arts Movement Business District from August 1st to the 3rd. And I will be there doing something over the weekend because I'm excited about it. That's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darden. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Wrangle, our board operator, Damian Miner, and our director of audio programming, David Boyer. And thank you for tuning in. I went on vacation, so that's why I'm all like, look. I want to acknowledge two people who have passed on. One is Malcolm Jamal Warner. I got to meet him when I was a producer at NPR's West Coast Bureau, and he was a kind, generous, and respectful man, just as you've heard from others. Also earlier this summer, activist and artist Greg Morizumi passed away, and he co-founded the Eastside Arts Alliance in East Oakland. And we worked with him at KLW with our East Oakland project, and his passing is a huge loss for the community. So two artists who inspire so many people, we got to keep their good energy going because they left us something good. We'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. And until then, take care and be good to yourselves, and take care and be good to each other.